get started with the Q&A time now. A couple announcements before we start the Q&A. First announcement is we have our next 21-plus night coming up this Friday. That's a night once a month. We reopen our building for grown-ups to come and have fun in all of our exhibits without any little kids running around. So there's a full bar, live music. There are lots of fun. Next one's this Friday, December 6th. The theme is holiday party. So wear your ugly Christmas sweaters and enjoy some science-y holiday activities. Also, because of the busy holiday season, there is no Cafe Sci in January. We take January off for Cafe Sci, and we will resume our Cafe Sci's in February. All right, so we're still trying new things with our Q&A for those of you who have been here before. We used to bring the microphone around to people in the audience. We're trying it different. We're going to have the microphone stationary. It's right up there where Ashley is modeling it. So if you have a question, you can make your way up to the microphone. We'll hopefully be able to get this a little bit easier. And if you have any feedback about the system, let me know. We're just trying it out. So you can ask your question. We'll get our answers, and we'll see how this goes. So if anybody has any questions, you're welcome to the microphone. Again, we're recording all of this for the podcast. So speak into the microphone. Speak loudly into the microphone so everybody can hear you and so that we can catch it for the recording. All right, I'll turn it back over to Dr. Beckman.
The floor is yours now. Ah, we have a brave first questioner. Excellent. Several.
This thing on?
I don't know.
Okay. You hear me? Okay. One of the big things in the news today is the fossil fuel versus green energy debate and controversy. And we quite often hear how if it's green, it must be clean, wind and solar. They're obviously excellent choices, but we don't hear from environmental groups or advocates are the real life cycle assessment impacts and the environmental footprint. And it's almost like some of the marketing. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, the green energy?
Greenest energy there is the energy you never use. So that's the first thing. Innovating by subtraction again. No one ever wants to use energy. That's never your desired outcome. Your desired outcomes include lights on when I'm trying to read, heat on when it's January in Pittsburgh, heat on when it's February in Pittsburgh, heat on when it's March. No, you get the picture. But the desired outcomes never include burning stuff. Well, I guess for some small pyromaniacal section of society. But it never includes combustion, using energy. So the desired outcome is always a result of using energy. Energy is a means to an end. So the key is use less. The biggest single thing that any of you can do to be greener is use less electricity. The U.S. electricity grid is one-third efficient. For every 3 units of energy we consume anywhere, 1 gets to your house. 2 are wasted. So you save 1 at your house, you save 3 somewhere else. So that's the single biggest thing you can do is efficiency, is conserving energy. As to life cycle impacts, there's actually a number of studies on different types of energy. The problem is that we're still dealing with differences in scale. The scale of generation using traditional fossil fuels is much larger still than the scale of generating electricity using some of the other techniques. But wind is catching up. We have enough scale in wind so that we can actually look at environmental impacts of wind-based energy. Nothing has a zero impact. Always remember that. And when you look at grades, they're going to be different again. Obviously, greenhouse gases, wind-based energy is going to win by a lot. And other things, land use, fossil fuels may win because wind energy uses a lot of land. But at the end of the day, use less. You can't lose that way. And you'll save money. The trick is just to keep your desired outcomes firmly in mind. So that's my green energy spiel is let's not use as much. I mean, what's ironic is that we may make fun of California a lot, which I do too, because I have a sister out there. And it's kind of required. You're supposed to make fun of your baby sister. But California, for the last 25 years, energy use per capita has been flat. No one saves energy like California, strangely enough. Obviously, their population is going up, but energy per capita use is... They haven't had any real increases for 20 years. It's remarkable. So, I mean, this can be done. Next. How do I explain that? Energy-efficient buildings is a big part of it. That's where you use a ton of energy. And use of more energy-efficient cars. Those are the two big ones.
Are there any small business incubators for entrepreneurs starting eco-innovation companies in Pittsburgh?
No. That's the easiest one I've had to ask. No. Even if you made that the United States, it's still few and far between. There's actually the problem with small businesses that are trying to be greener is that this was called clean tech starting about 2005. Initially, all clean tech investments were going towards so-called green energy ideas, green energy businesses. Those need a tremendous amount of money to get to the point where they can be economical because of the scale of the energy industry. So you could say, let's say a Series A, a starting investment from a venture capitalist in a small business might be between $1 and $5 million. That only gets you like 1% of the way in an energy business you need to get to commercialization. $1 to $5 million gets you 150% of the way that you need to commercialize an app or something like Pinterest or Instagram. And so initial clean tech investments were following energy things. And then this led to disillusionment because they didn't get very far because it was not enough money. And then other types of clean tech have suffered as a result. Now, there is one guy out in California. His name is Vinod Khosla. He is one of the founders of Sun Microsystems. He's one of the five Sun founders. So he did rather well for himself when Sun was sold, when Sun went public. He runs Khosla Ventures. It's one of the few VC funds out there that's still devoted to looking for green ideas, and they go beyond energy. But an incubator that deals just with green, there are very few incubators in Pittsburgh, quite frankly. And most of them are devoted to either life sciences, medicine, and things digital. But things green, we don't have anything yet. But there it's more a question of finding a receptive VC, one who has survived the disillusionment of the first 5 years of clean tech.
I had to roll my eye a little bit when you were talking about a lack of conspiracy. I mean, I always see reduction as being impacted by enormous resistance from, of course, the companies, the owners, the stockholders, the employees of these interim companies that are being eliminated when you are reducing. And I think that most marketing departments know what they're doing when they present specious, somewhat inaccurate information. I mean, the whole idea is to just make money. That's all we really care about, is making money. So I'm not sure. I don't know how you confront that. I think that's why the progress is so very slow, because there are so many moneyed interests trying to maintain the status quo for all kinds of reasons, but mostly about money.
But always remember that 15 years ago, the idea of carrying our music around on our phones was insane. The idea of carrying anything around on our phones was perceived as ridiculous. And, of course, Apple was seen as, you know, it was one of those companies for just wealthy Californians, you know, who were hipsters. Yeah. But, of course, then they blew people out of the water. And then we have Google. It's just two knuckleheaded grad students from Stanford who had an idea on search. Oh, and now they're doing robotic cars and a lot of other things. The key is that it can be resistance, but that they're going to go extinct. Simple. And the thing is that most of the marketing people I talk to don't know what the words life cycle analysis strung together like. They know what they mean separately, but they've never heard of them together. So I don't think they're trying to rig the life cycle stuff. I just think that they actually think that if it comes from a plant, it's green. I have a lot of people who firmly believe green is it comes from a plant. And when they get into marketing positions and they say, it's from a plant. And you say, is it green? It's from a plant. My favorite one was I worked with a hospital system out in California. And they were very proud. They told me, we replaced all of our baseboards. That they were PVC. And I was like, great. What did you replace them with? They said, polyurethane. I said, well, how do you know it's greener? Well, it's not PVC. Hence was born the famous not PVC metric. And I honestly think that that's how people process this. The idea of doing lots of nerdly stuff and comparing life cycle impacts, it doesn't occur to them. They like that it's from a plant. And they can show me it. They prove it. It's from a plant. I'm like, yeah, it's from a plant. I believe you. And they think that that makes it greener. They really do. They've internalized that. By the same token, you know, big companies that resist, they do that all the time. That's their nature. And so most big companies know that they cannot innovate. They are clear on that. And so they have ways of dealing with that. One is they have an internal VC group whose job it is to invest in potential competitors of the future. So even if they themselves can't innovate, at least they can buy their way into the people that do. Johnson & Johnson, creator of Band-Aids, was an early investor in Closure Medical who invented liquid bandage. And so, I mean, they have ways of understanding that they can't innovate because they know that either someone will innovate for them or they'll die. I don't think that they like making money. That's part of sustainability. But I just don't think that I don't think they know enough to create a conspiracy. I could, but I wouldn't. You guys would never know. But I just don't think they know enough. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Talking about sustainability and things like that, I'm wondering, how do you feel about, in the future, solar energy in terms of, what are your feelings about that, pro, con, or anything at all?
Well, I like it. I like solar. There are things that have to be worked out. There's some technological issues. In other words, we've done really, first of all, solar, what happens is when you generate solar power, it's DC. It's DC energy. Our houses run off of AC, so we have to convert it. A lot of the cost of a solar array, the panels have come down a lot, not for reasons you people will like very much. It's because the Chinese make, you know, solar panels out the wazoo. Maybe not so good. But we have to focus on other things. The things that convert the electricity from DC to AC are some of the most expensive parts of the system now. And the problem is that's boring. People like me like to work on the elegant stuff. But then there are the boring, necessary things. So I think solar has legs. I just think that what we need is, again, additional innovation to lower the cost of some of the parts of it. I also like some of the really interesting business models I've seen in states like, unfortunately, not Pennsylvania, but New Jersey and Louisiana, believe it or not, and California, where you have a company that actually rents you the panels. Okay? It says, we'll put the panels on your roof. We'll install them. But we still own them. We're basically renting, and you will pay us a certain monthly fee for electricity. So you know what you're going to be paying. It's less than what you'd pay Duquesne Light, but it's enough for us, plus the subsidies we get from the feds and from the states for us to make a profit. It's kind of a cool business model, but it only works in states that will subsidize solar power. And believe it or not, one of the best for that, Louisiana. They have great subsidies. New Jersey had great subsidies. California has good subsidies. And what that does, of course, is that lowers pressure on the grid so that we don't need as many power plants. If people are generating on their own, that's a good thing. The biggest single user of water in the United States is electric power generation. Domestically, of course, it's flushing toilets. Two very different things. But, you know, so putting less pressure on the grid is a good thing. So I like it. I just see it's always room for improvement. I think it's generally a good thing. Yes?
Hi. I want to talk about grading for just a minute. You mentioned ozone depletion and that it's not a concern any longer. Is part of the reason for that in fact there was this laser focus on the ozone issue and there were things that dramatically changed? In other words, people did things differently.
That's part of it. Okay. Definitely part of it, and also because with ozone depletion, it was all about one class of things, CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, right. And particularly the chlorine part.
Right.
The fluorocarbon part, creates problems with greenhouse emissions, but the chlorine part is what did it. So it was snipping off the chlorine, got rid of it because it was the chlorine that was fragmenting up in the upper atmosphere, and then the chlorine would go after the ozone, essentially. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it probably was. And you know, the fact that the international community came together and could ban this one sort of narrow but really useful class of chemicals. Here's the irony with ozone depletion is in the 20s, we used to use ammonia for refrigeration. Isn't that great? It's like, oh, that sounds safe. But, you know, but ammonia is non-flammable, so that's cool. But we used to use ammonia. And when CFCs were invented in the 20s, they were a miracle chemical. Mm-hmm. They were inexpensive. They were stable, not like ammonia, which reacts mm-hmm. with stuff. They were non-toxic and non-flammable. Mm-hmm. It was like CFCs. No one knew that there was an ozone layer. And, of course, the fact that they were so stable meant that they were safe to use, but also it was really easy for them to get to the upper atmosphere. So it's interesting, you know, as we gain knowledge, things change. But I think you're right. I think it was the fact that we saw this, we were able to focus on it, mm-hmm. we were able to draw a boundary around it.
Right.
Look at greenhouse gases. It includes CO2 from burning, methane that leaks out of our gas wells, fluorocarbons that we created to replace the chlorofluorocarbons. That they don't damage the ozone layer, but there are hundreds to thousands of times more potent greenhouse gases. So it comes mm-hmm. from the aerosols that we spray on ourselves, greenhouse gases. So that one has an enormous boundary, and it's very hard for us to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right on ozone. It was nice and simple.
But my point is about water, because there are many, many, many people who are starting to talk about this is going to be, you know, what we go to war over. And so shouldn't that be a little high, you know, shouldn't there be some kind of weight for, like, water usage? You know, I would argue that, you know, perhaps even more than carbon, you know, that we do some type of, you know, carbon tax or something like that, that we shouldn't, like, focus on water because, in fact,
it's one where, depending on where you are, if we were in Phoenix, there would be yes by acclamation.
Mm-hmm.
We're in Pittsburgh. Our problem isn't quantity, it's quality. We have a lot of water, and it's mixed with varying things that we really don't want to, you know, that shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
What you've brought up is a classic question. What should the weighting be? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what BASF does. This is a large chemical company. They have a system that they've created called the Eco-Efficiency Index, where they take all those grades I showed you and telescope them into one final grade. Mm-hmm. And they use weighting factors for it. Just as you say, they weight things. Now, how do they determine the weighting factors? In each of the regions where they do business, European Union, North mm-hmm. America, East Asia, South Asia, Australia, they ask stakeholders to vote. And then they take those weightings. Now, that means you have equal number of votes. The environmental minister of Germany gets a vote, and so does the guy that runs the sausage cart mm-hmm. in the main square. But they ask their stakeholders to vote what they think. So in other words, that slide I showed you with all those weightings from average people,
right.
they get those from different regions, and that's how they weight their scores. Is that right? I don't know, but they're transparent. Mm-hmm. I like that. They see this is how we mm-hmm. do it. You can argue with us if you want. We love to argue.
Mm.
But this is how we do it. And I don't know of a one-size-fits-all, but I just got to tell you, that's how BASF does it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they deal with the questions you just asked, because there's no rigorous scientific way to deal with it.
And so how do you best manage the public discourse on something?
No, I don't.
Like this.
I myself am
could,
un-
if
well,
you could.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask I'm unmanageable. So you're asking an interesting question. I don't know. What I want to see and what irritates me is lack of transparency. You know, for someone like me, like I said, faculty sometimes, we're the best critics in the world. We can poke holes in anything. We're trained for decades to just skewer stuff. And we need data for that, though. We need to be able to see when someone says this is green or the impacts are better. We need some transparency. Now, the better companies out there are doing that. Notice that I showed you life cycle data that were created for NatureWorks on the mm-hmm. polylactic acid. Now, they only put the good stuff, they only published the good stuff
right.
in their ads, but it was easy for me to find the whole report.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at it and said, oh, not a surprise. Fossil fuel, they did better. And, oh, eutrophication, they screwed up completely. And mm-hmm. so did acidification. I was expecting that because it comes from a farm plant.
Mm-hmm.
But that's important. If you have transparency, then you can see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I had to manage it, that's what I'd say. Look, if you're going to call something green, you have to show me why.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
And be able to defend it. Could be. Yeah, if things work out badly, it's like no one likes to show their bad grades. But actually, some people lately are beginning to thrive on it, to be able to show that, because what they're doing actually is the people that show greenhouse gas emissions have already made the assumption, they're doing the weighting that you, wherever you went, because the light's in my eyes, so I can't see. You're over there. Okay. They're doing the weighting that you asked. They're saying that, in our opinion, we think our customers are more interested in greenhouse gas emissions, so we're going to publish those. And in fact, we'll publish the other data. The scores we do worse on, we're not going to worry about it, because we think our public is like the public I showed you on the slide, that they think greenhouse gas emissions are the most important. So what you're seeing is that now. You're seeing more transparency from the people, because you're seeing more understanding of life cycle analysis. 10 years ago, life cycle analysis was something that was only done by a very small number of people. Now, we have courses. We have a course at Pitt, semester long, how to do life cycle analysis, so that students in engineering can learn. Then they can go to work at places and say, hey, why aren't we doing LCA? And so it's infiltrating companies who at first said, life cycle what? It comes from a plant. So now they're starting to do it the right way, because there are more people that know how to do it the right way. So it's a slow subversion, if you will.
It occurs to me that as a factor that you must consider is, how long do you take your analysis for? I mean, if you look at cell phones and you say 18 months, well, I keep mine for 3, 4, 5 years. Clearly, I get more out of it that way. And I wonder how you do take that into effect. I mean, I remember some people said when a Prius came out that it was actually worse environmentally because getting the batteries together took so much more energy. But clearly, if you take a Prius and run it for 10 or 15 years, how do you develop standards for the time frame you do for an LCA?
The time frame is based on average lifetime. And so a classic one is cars. Because when we do, if you look at a car, what's really interesting is, and this is true for anything that uses energy during its lifetime, so it's a little bit of a special category, is after about the first 3 months, the energy use starts to dominate everything. And so that the longer it goes, it's really the more energy it uses. But we have to do for cars and washing machines, we have to take an average lifetime. And so, for example, somebody, and this is interesting because I've done studies on this, let's say I have one of those old refrigerators in my basement. This is called mea culpa. I'm confessing to a green sin. I have one of these old refrigerators in the basement, which we call the 7-Eleven, because it's filled with drinks that are bad for me and ice cream that's bad for me and other things that are bad for me. If I could sneak Twinkies in the house, they'd be in there too. But the 7-Eleven is a 20-year-old refrigerator. So on the one hand, the fact that I'm using it for a long time is good, but it's an energy hog compared to newer models. And so when you look at this, you have to factor some of these things in. So, for example, a refrigerator today, if we did a life cycle analysis on it, we'd take an average lifetime for the refrigerator projected for the best available information, and we would use whatever energy it's using. If we did the same life cycle analysis back in 1995, we'd get a very different answer because it was much more of an energy hog. And on anything that's got a lifetime of more than about 6 weeks and uses energy, that's the 8,000-pound gorilla. The same with your phone. At a certain point, your phone, the impacts are going to be due to as much to its energy use as anything else. And so, you know, your phone, keeping it for 5 years, on the one hand, that's good, because the end-of-life issues, you're doing better on those because your heavy metals are not being dispersed. On the other hand, it might be an energy hog compared to or might be better, I don't know. An iPhone uses a lot of energy and it's heavier. We actually try to incorporate all of these things. And so what you have to do is, again, define your system. I'm talking about iPhone 5s using a projected lifespan of X. And the iPhone 5 is the design as of today. And then do the LCA. And so that's why when you see life cycle analysis of phones, it's first like, well, what phone? Life cycle analysis of cars, and you never see of cars, you see of specific cars. Life cycle analysis of an electric car, and you find out, oh, it's this kind, it's the Chevy Volt, and that's been done. And so it's You know, again, it's just if you do it right, if you define your system well, part of that is the projected lifetime. And in products that don't use energy, like a pipe in your house, the key is long life. Because you're getting, every time the water goes through, that's another use. And part of life cycle analysis is the number of uses you get out of the product. And extending it out is just universally a good thing. So it's defining your system. So it is doable. Oh, I can actually can see you now if I do this.
Another question about the Prius. I guess last year I was purchasing a car, and until you are able to then do the cost-benefit analysis of about 25,000 miles, it's really not then worth the expenditure. Is it more that we have to step back and say it's the zip cars that we should be thinking about the sharing rather than a actual purchasing? Because otherwise, unless there's subsidies, we're not going to have an advantage. And my second quick question was, you were talking about the different materials in hospitals that would decrease bacteria. They already exist in nature. Sterling is the perfect example. Are we sometimes, you know, doing something new to reinvent, you know, something that's already there?
Interesting. I'll do the second one first, because any of you guys see Master and Commander, the film? Oh, all right. And the guy had the head injury, and you see what they did? They put a silver coin in it. Silver is an antibacterial, but now it kills bacteria. And so it's actually regulated by the EPA as an antibacterial, as like a it's a biocide. And so it's toxic, not only to the bacteria, but actually to you. And so the surface I showed you keeps bacteria from sticking. It doesn't kill them. It just says, you can't stop here. Move along, nothing to see. You know, so think of it as, you know, the cop that you experiment with, nothing to see here, move along, where silver actually kills. And in fact, one of the interesting uses of silver is a group called Potters for Peace. I love these guys. They created a clay pot. They mixed the clay with sawdust. So when they fired it, it had pores in it. It had small holes. The sawdust basically just disintegrated, evaporated. So now it was a filter. They also impregnated it with silver particles. So now it was an antibacterial filter. They used it after Hurricane Mitch in Nicaragua when the Nicaraguan water system went kablooey. And people were able to fill. And you can make the pots on site because you just need clay and sawdust. The silver was a bit of a problem, so they eventually switched to copper. But that's actually a bactericide. The surface keeps them from sticking. Your second question was on, oh, yeah, zip cars versus, this is interesting. And this goes from when you take product to service, which is really a really nice way of doing innovation by subtraction. Some product to service transformations are so obvious to us that we don't think about them. Who owns a copy machine? No, not me. We rent them in the office. And some guy named Lenny comes in every 12 minutes and fixes them. But see, I knew you knew Lenny. For any Lennies in the audience, mea culpa, as per usual. I have a whole list of apologies that will be sent out at the end. But no one owns a copy machine. You lease them. There's a company called Interface in Georgia that tried to pilot the leasing of carpet. They rented the carpet to you, and at the end they took it back and then recycled it. And so some areas were not familiar with renting of carpet. Zip cars are new, but you know they're catching on, and there are some large companies that are betting, making financial bets that in the future no one will own a car. That it'll be seen as just as silly to own a car as it is to own a copy machine. And the wonderful thing about a car, a car is a fascinating device. It weighs, 2,000 pounds? This is the engineer approximating. So it weighs 2,000 pounds. Most of the time it sits and does nothing. And then occasionally it picks up a 200-pound, possibly increasing, depending on which country we're talking about, a 200-pound person and moves them around. But mostly it moves itself around. And then the rest of the time it just sits still. And so it almost begs to be turned into a service. And that's why you see Zipcar taking off in various places. And so, honestly, there are companies like Google that have made financial bets that in a decade or so, we won't own them anymore. We'll always just use them as services. And it'll be just as weird as owning a copy machine. What are you, nuts? So product to services is a very interesting model. And like I said, as people prove it out, Zipcar, did they do an IPO recently? Or they bought? Hertz bought them? Yeah, and so the initial founders and investors in Zipcar, they did okay. This is what gets people's eyes lit up. It's like, they made how much? And I think we'll see more of it. Yes?
This is a very basic question.
In other words, I might actually be able to answer it.
Plastic versus glass bottles.
Right.
And what is the beginning and the end of using either one?
Okay. Obviously, glass starts out as sand. And then you have to heat it to several thousand degrees to make a bottle. Plastic starts out as petroleum or natural gas. Most of the bottles you see, the clear ones, are polyester. They're basically the same polyester that it goes into it. All right, now we get the people that were around in the 70s, the leisure suit, remember that? Who owned one? No, don't admit it, it's okay. You know, I'll lose respect for you if you admit it. So it's polyester, okay? Polyester starts out, part of it starts out as natural gas, and part of it starts out as part of petroleum, and then you have polyester. What's interesting is, in theory, both of them are easily recyclable. Easily recyclable. Glass, you just remelt it, clean it, it's fine. The polyester, easy to recycle. What it actually comes down to is, if you think about it, is the weight. You know, a glass bottle of a given volume weighs at least twice as much as a polyester bottle, at least twice as much. And so if you're moving these things around, you're spending energy just to move stuff around. And so, you know, they have individual differences in impact. Quite frankly, the glass is more of an energy-intensive material to make. But glass is recycled at a higher rate than the polyester right now. The polyester people would love for that to increase because there's pressure on polyester prices right now. They would love to get more back if they could. So you've got some individual differences, but it may come down just to the transport, impacts due to transport. One is much heavier than the other. Because otherwise they're doing the same thing. They're just holding something temporarily. And the problem is both have a very short lifespan. What I like are the things that remember, I mean, the old days when you had the jelly container. This is really old. So those of you that are much younger than me, don't make fun, particularly students who want grades of any sort. You'd get grape jelly, horrible grape jelly, but I loved it as a child. And then when the thing was done, it was a juice glass. See, that's what I like. I like those things. And, you know, we loved those juice glasses as kids, and we used them, you know, until they were practically destroyed. But you can still get them? Excellent. Now I've learned something. I'm going out for... Great. The trouble, of course, is the jelly, you know. Why did I like that stuff? All right, but, I mean, that's what I like to see, is that if there was... If you had a glass bottle that could be really easily converted into something where you just kept using it, oh, now that's good stuff. Yes, sir?
So part of that is the recycling rates. I also look at some products that are labeled as compostable, having put those into my own compost bin at home, and a year or two later I can get that fork out, and probably if I wanted to, I could reuse it. How do you dial that into those things? Because... there are variable rates of what gets recycled.
Yeah, and that's just part of the transparency. For example, what's interesting is that right now economics drives recycling. Alcoa wants to get every scrap of aluminum. I'm surprised that there aren't Alcoa people in here. Are there right now checking for cans, you know? Because the difference in energy to make a can from a recycled hunk of aluminum versus to extract the aluminum from bauxite and all the impacts and the cost is astronomical. And so if you're Alcoa, it's like, oh, please give me back the cans, for God's sake. So their economics is driving responsible environmental behavior because the difference between virgin and recycled is so huge in costs of all sort, waste disposal, energy, processing, oh, you name it. When it comes to plastics, part of the problem is that for some plastics, we've gotten really good at making them. Polyolefins, polyethylene, polypropylene, things like Hefty bags. Oh, we can make gazillions of pounds of that stuff for really low processing costs. It turns out that the raw material, the monomer, is well over 80% of the cost of the final article because we've done so good a job at making it. Those are hard to induce recycling. You have to collect them. They're lightweight. That's good. But then we have to move lightweight stuff and then recycle it. Polyester, fortunately, the thing in bottles, is there's a lot of pressure on prices of the raw materials. It's part of the petroleum stream called the BTX stream. I don't want to get too nerdly here, but it's a slice of petroleum that's getting squeezed because lots of people want it. And so the polyester people would be like, either A, please find a way to make that raw material from natural gas. That's their one, like, wish. And two, please find a way to gather back as much of this polyester as we can because there's still an economic driving force to recycle it. So it differs based on the material. And you just have to find what are the published rates. I mean, there's nothing stopping them from recycling the polyester, and they desperately want more. It's a question of efficient collection schemes. Now, composting, yikes. These things started out as they were called degradable polymers until we found out that they didn't in landfills, that nothing does. There's a guy in Arizona, an anthropology professor, that's made his career mining landfills and analyzing the results and publishing papers on what we were like 40 years ago based on the trash that hasn't degraded a bit. So they don't degrade in landfills. They won't degrade typically in your composter. They degrade under specific conditions with some certain bacteria, inoculate with certain bacteria in professionally managed composters. So to me, it's kind of a BS thing to say that they're degradable. I don't call that degradable. And in fact, they're switching that. They used to, those were these some of the polyesters that were labeled. You don't see that as much anymore. Now you see more that there are disposal options because they learned that, oh, it doesn't degrade. And now they say it comes from a plant. And now we're back to my slide one again. But that's how they're, and that's true, but because their initial claim that it was degradable didn't wash, and they learned that, they realized, we can't say it anymore. So it's an example, once they learned, oh, this doesn't work, they had to stop saying it, and now that's been taken out, now it comes from a plant, and we generate fewer greenhouse gas emissions. It's back to that again, because it doesn't. And so for me, I don't like that stuff for so many different reasons. If I look at bulk density, it's 30% more dense than the plastics it's replacing. It's like running a race, and you give me a third of a mile head start, and it's a mile race. Hey, I'm 55. I bet you I could still win with that much of a head start. So, you know, there's so many things wrong with it. It's not funny. And that's just one of them. So, but you're right. It's not going to degrade. Paul.
Sure.
You can take your coat off and stay, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's just so comfortable now. I'm trying to be sustainable. So you mentioned the economic impact, but I'm wondering, is it often that the culture becomes the tipping point for when sustainable practice really takes hold? Like when you think, for example, of Pittsburgh in the 40s and moving from essentially banning coal furnaces, moving to natural gas.
Are you
gas.
Implying that I was here in the 40s?
No. All right. Not at all. And then you look at societies like China, which is accelerating quickly economically, but is still having problems with pollution, or Poland, where Krakow is now banning coal furnaces for the same reason that Pittsburgh did 70 years ago.
Yeah, behavior is a huge part of this. There's actually a field of science called persuasive technology, which is a combination of computer science and psychology. A lot of you think of that and go, oh, my God, it's like that's creating a monster. But a great example is that those of you that have cars that tell you the mileage in real time on the dashboard, I have a little Volkswagen Jetta that does that. And when I'm on long trips on, like, the flatlands of Ohio, it's like a game. I say, what can I do to make the mileage go up? And, in fact, it is a game, and it's known that that works. It's called persuasive technology. There are meters now that show you how you're doing, electricity usage-wise. There was a group at Oberlin College. A group of students created a system so that the different floors of the dorms could track their electricity and water usage in real time. And of course, the kids turned it into a contest. And once they did, the administration thought, we're going to make money off of this deal. So the least we could do, which is what they did, of course, is to say the winner would get an ice cream party. And so, you know, having the meters allowed this, you know, this race to go on. And that's part of persuasive technology, designing things that will help change behavior. There are smart meters at home now that will broadcast. I like this one that will tell you what your electricity usage is and then also what the neighbors are doing. because, you know, it's like, I'm not letting Eddie beat me on this. You know, he can barely read, you know, so it's that kind of thing, you know, it's like, what is it, Pittsburgh Dad? It's like Tom's house. I'm not letting Tom beat me on this one. And that's what it comes down to. So behavior is a huge part of it. And there are people trying to create technology that influences us to do the right thing, not always for the right reason necessarily, but we end up making it a habit. I mean, how many of you guys wear seatbelts and feel like if you didn't put the seatbelt on, you would think, God, it's something wrong with the car. Oh, wait, no, it's the belt. I mean, it's become a habit, and once you can turn it into a habit, it sticks. This is why even something simple like little bins at home for recycling, if you have the bin, I should put something in it. And the presence of the bin changes your behavior. If you were told, okay, just take your recyclables, put them in a separate bag, tie it up and put it, no. But having the bin actually helps to alter your behavior and to recycle more. It's strange, but it's behavioral economics is a burgeoning field, and persuasive technology is part of that. It's a little scary at times when you think our products are inducing us to do things, you know, but that's part of it. Yeah, that's a scandal. I remember in Pittsburgh, I still remember this, a reporter, this was when the prices for plastics were low, and the deal that the city had signed with the recycler was not a very good one. And a reporter followed the truck, picked up the recyclables, and drove right to the landfill and dumped them. And, you know, I think that that's less prevalent today. And again, the reason is the polyester has substantial value. Taking those polyester bottles, which make up the bulk of the things you throw out, you can't just throw those out. They're too valuable. And it's because the cost of the raw materials for making polyester has gone up as there's been substantial demand for it from a variety of industries. So I think there's less of that simply because it's too valuable to throw away now. But, oh, yeah, in the past there were all sorts of scandals. I remember those. The question, again, for those who didn't hear, was are the plastics really being recycled? And in the past, oh, yeah, there were scandals where they weren't being. That's because their value was so low. The equation has changed. Polyester value is too high. Stupid to throw it away now. You can make, I mean, Patagonia's model would fall apart. They take the polyester and turn it into trendy clothing that we buy and spend a lot of money on. So, you know, without the bottles, their business model isn't as good anymore. So, yeah.
What percentage of the stuff that can be recycled and is in demand is coming back in terms of what's out there?
Again, it varies. Aluminum is very high.
It is.
Yeah, very high because of the value. Polyester is still probably less than 50%. And a lot of other plastics is very low. Again, one of the other things, if I said things you could do is that allow you to be greener is things that have a single use and go right in the trash. That's just not good. And that includes wasted food. We waste half of the food we buy. And remember, farming isn't free from an environment. There's one. I'm pretty sure, well, it depends, not a Twinkie. But just about any other thing that classifies as food will decompose in a compost heap. So, yeah, no meat, that's true. Good point. But, I mean, it varies. There are some plastics where the recycling rate is very low because, again, the value is low. And this is, unfortunately, the polyolefins, polyethylene, which is in packaging and hefty bags and things, polypropylene, like potato chip bags and such. The recycling rate is really low because the value is so low. These things are very cheap. And so that's part of the problem.
But most of that is not degradable.
None of it's degradable. No, that's there forever. Honestly, anything in a landfill does not contain the proper conditions for decomposition of any sort. Hot dogs will sit there, the wonder of nitrates, but hot dogs will be there intact 40 years after you put them in the ground. So a landfill is the worst environment there is for decomposition.
Are they treating landfills?
No.
Is that something to consider?
I don't know. You're out of my field.
How about I ask that for you? So, the recycling
and oxygen.
And you get groundwater contamination. So to prevent one thing, you're actually preventing the decomposition. That's the whole idea of a sanitary landfill.
There was a move several years ago to create landfills that were specifically designed to create and make methane.
True.
And they supposedly work, but I haven't heard anything about it in a long time.
They do. I mean, you get methane from most landfills. I mean, you often see the pipes. It's one is for safety, and then now, of course, you know, you can do stuff with it.
Yeah, there's methane, like the largest landfill in the world, Fresh Tools Landfill in New York City.
That's
all
a classic.
All the groundwater treatment systems, all the on-site energy use generated on-site by methane. If you ever go to Staten Island, you drive by Fresh Tools, you'll see a large electrical power plant that's all in landfill methane. And EPA has a big effort to get landfills that do generate methane to use that as power.
Yeah, that's a different type of digestion. That's digestion without oxygen, then you get methane. Otherwise, with oxygen, you get CO2. But, you know, and it works. It's just that it's for mining, the volumes are not great enough. The volumes are good enough to run on-site stuff to make sure the landfill's operating, but they're not enough to make it into a... It's not going to compete with a traditional gas well.
Eric,
hey.
Quick question for you on the recycling. You see the numbers on the different plastic containers.
Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit what those numbers mean and how they affect the?
It's the different numbers just refer to the different types of plastic. I mean, if you look at the plastics we run into most of the time in our daily lives, probably the top one is polyethylene. Okay. And again, I always refer to good old hefty bag. It's found in plastic bags, Ziploc bags and garbage bags and things. It's a very light material. It's really energy efficient to make. It does not degrade one bit. And it's really inexpensive. And so that gets a number. There are two types of polyethylenes, and they each get their own number. Okay? Then there's polyester, PET. You'll see it even says PET or PETE. It's the same thing. Soda bottles. Pop bottles, that gets a number. Polypropylene, that gets a number. Things like yogurt cups. The numbers refer to the different types of plastics. And the reason they're there is that some recycling systems will only take certain ones. And it's meant as a guide to you. If your town says, we'll recycle plastics, but we only want 1, 2, and 3. Can't have anything else. And you can look at it and say, can we recycle this? And, oh, it's a 3. Boom, into it. They're meant for you. It's really a way of dividing the different types of plastics into their fundamental molecular type as a guide to recycling. Because at the end of the day, the recyclers, they get most of the money from the PET, the polyester. They get a little bit from the others, the polyethylene, the polypropylene. Most of the money comes from the polyester. And then the other things, they have no use for. So the number's there, so they know we don't want that. We can't reprocess that. We can't do anything with it. So that's what they're there for. They just refer to different types.
I'd like to get back to what you were talking about, saying that they might be using mines at the landfills. Do you foresee a time when they might go back to all these landfills to mine it and recycle it for all the resources that they've now learned how to recycle? Do you see that as a future industry?
Well, one thing that for example, we already do is it comes down to right now economic value. For example, every bit of electronics you own has gold in it. And you better believe that when electronics are returned, that's one of the things they want the most. The other thing you've probably heard of is rare earths. That's been in the news. They're actually not that rare. I don't name these things. I'm not in charge. But rare earths are a type of element. And they're really useful in a variety of technology products, for example, making high-strength magnets and things of that nature. And so recycling those from trash is really important. It comes down to what it is you're looking for and what concentration it is. It's the same decision that they make when digging a hole in the ground is, all right, what's the value of what we're trying to get out? And what's the concentration? Is there, a lot per cubic meter of dirt or a little bit? If there's a lot, it's like, let's go for this. Because the processing costs are going to be the same regardless. That's the key. And it's how much you get out at the end that's important. So for anything in a landfill, it depends on how much is there. And can we ascertain that with any clarity? In other words, we say, oh, look, there's a landfill. I'm pretty sure that electronics were dumped illegally there for 15 years. How do we make sure that's true? Because if they are, then maybe there's a lot of valuable elements in there that we can go after. That's what it's going to come down to. And right now, again, for most elements out there that we value, the landfills aren't to that point yet. And what's interesting is when their value goes up, for example, as we saw before the last recession, you started to see copper being stolen from abandoned houses. Why? The value of copper went up. Steel being stolen. Cables being stolen off of poles. I love that one. You know, they would come out and the poles would be empty. The cable was gone. This thing weighed a lot, but it had value. So in other words, you know, when you start to see random thievery directed at elements, you know that the value has gotten to the point where maybe we could look at landfills as well. But that's what's going to drive this, is economic concentration. And, you know, with thievery, it's like, well, the copper is up there in the wire. I figure I can get it down, so we'll go for it. And what's the worst that can happen? You know, 3 years in jail, but they went for it anyway. I'm amazed at but, you know, it tracked perfectly with the value of copper at the time. We had the recession, that fell, and a lot of that thievery went away.
I grew up in Washington in a very...
State or D.C.?
State. In a very paper-making orientated town.
So you were near Walla Walla?
Actually, Longview, which is closer to Portland.
Okay.
But we were often taught that paper and producing it was a lot more environmentally sound than plastic. And so I was kind of surprised to see paper towels rated quite higher. I was wondering if you could explain that.
Well, you've seen a paper plant, right? The problem with this is that if you look at when we have paper, we use just the cellulose. We have to separate that from the lignin, okay? The way we do that and break down the cellulose that we can make use of it is we cook it. It's the Kraft process, and it uses, well, the equivalent of oven cleaner, essentially heated to great extent. It's a nasty process, and it produces a lot of emissions, and you use a lot of water to make paper, to process it. And so, you know, there may have been a time when they were similar, but not anymore. The other thing right now, so let's say we have the equivalent volume. I have a sheet of plastic and a sheet of paper. The paper is going to weigh 30% more. And when we use stuff, we use it by volume, okay? You never go in and say, you know, I'd like 30 pounds of bottles, please. No, typically you ask for, I'd like a dozen bottles. Or I'd like, you know, 4 pounds of paper towels. No, usually, I mean, you say I'd like 4 rolls of paper towels. So we use things on a volume basis, but we create them on a mass basis. So density is important. Paper's a lot more dense than plastic, most plastics that are used. And the process for making paper is messy. A lot of emissions. Very energy intensive, because you have to separate the part you need away from the part you don't need, the lignin. And again, the chemicals to do that, they have impacts. The oven cleaner part, the sodium hydroxide, that comes from the same process that we make chlorine gas from. We take salt and we use electricity to split it into chlorine and sodium hydroxide. 1 to 2% of the world's electricity goes into that process. And that then is one of the impacts of the paper process. So whatever you were taught, sorry. I have bad news. It's the bottom line at the end of the day, though, when you're as paper or plastic, the right answer is neither. Because you're using it once and tossing it. That's what's wrong. All of the impacts in those things are then, you know, they're gone. You've taken the material and you've pitched it. So you've basically thrown away all that energy and water and stuff you use. So paper versus plastic, it's a tie, basically. They both suck, so to speak. It's not a technical term, but it's the scoop. It's a terrible tie. One is worse than the other in some places. At the end of the day, if you bring a reusable bag, you're in much better shape because it's reusable. That's the only reason, because you're getting multiple uses out of it. Even if you have to put it in the washing machine, you're still doing better because of the multiple uses. Yeah.
I'm interested in your assessment of the greenness associated with substituting natural gas for coal and power generation and transportation.
I love that one because it's an easy one. When we burn stuff, the energy, okay, this is some nerd stuff, so just, this is your disclaimer. This is going to be a little nerdy. I love this. The energy comes from the carbon-hydrogen bonds, okay? So the ratio of the hydrogen to the carbon is what matters. In hydrogen fuel, there's no carbon, so the ratio is infinite, so hydrogen is like, yay. Natural gas is methane. The ratio is 4:1. That's good, because less carbon, more energy-producing things. That's good. Petroleum is 2.5, and coal is less than 2. And so if we look at, for the same amount of energy, it's going to be cleaner as we go from just the burning part, from natural gas to oil to coal, without question. So on just the burning part, that one's easy. Okay, now there's the extraction part, and we have to work on what are the impacts there. That's when it gets messier. That's when it gets messier. First of all, oil extraction, 6 tons or about 5 tons of water for every ton of petroleum. And, of course, that's oily water, so it has to be treated. Coal, if you've seen mountaintop removal for coal mining, that's a bloody nightmare. Okay, so the impacts are large there. Natural gas, most of the impacts, people focus on the fracturing, the hydrofracturing part, but most of the impacts are derived from seepage of methane from the formation around the outside of the casing that then gets into the water supply or the atmosphere. And methane is really potent greenhouse gas. So when it's just the combustion part, clear winner. Natural gas wins over oil, wins over coal. In addition, right now, natural gas is really cheap. And so natural gas plants are being built for no other reason than they're cheaper to run than coal plants. Flat out cheaper, by a lot. You'd have to be a moron to build a coal plant. I mean, because you're throwing money away. It's the same reason why nuclear plants are not being built. It's an economic argument. The dollars per kilowatt investment is just so different between the two. So that's one. But on the green part, combustion part, natural gas wins, and the extraction part, the impacts are all over the place. And so studies are still being done. And it's really, if you do the gas right, and they've demonstrated this down in Texas, where you limit the emissions of methane using best practices, then you can win on both.
How about the impact of not having to refine the natural gas compared to refining the oil to gasoline?
You know, it's interesting. That's actually a small part of it, believe it or not. And it's because we've gotten really good at the process part for economic reasons. A big part of the processing of petroleum is energy. And so chemical engineers have gotten really good at squeezing every last bit of productivity out of the energy they use for purely economic reasons. And what that's done is, of course, you know, change where the impacts come from. So most of the impacts are just now based on what kind of raw material you have in the extractive process rather than the processing part, which is interesting. But that's where it comes from. Is another one up there again? Zach.
I'll take up the last one. So since I can't trust the green labels on any of my products,
yeah,
what's the one thing me as a consumer can do to be more green?
Okay. I'm going to do 4 things because I'm an academic and I don't follow instructions. We talk about, one, use less electricity. That's an easy one. It's because the grid is 1/3 efficient, and it's not getting much more efficient these days. So that's a big one. However you do it, use less electricity, burn less fuel. Natural gas, gasoline, coal, whatever you burn, burn less. 3, waste less food. Food has an enormous impact. The way we grow food in the United States, tremendous impacts due to food production. And we throw out about half of it, more or less, which is crazy. Waste less food. And then 4, try to throw out less stuff after a single use. Again, you saw that up there, 75 million tons of packaging. You say, well, how can I do it? I don't know. But these are the things that the big impacts for us is electricity, burning fuel, wasting food, and throwing stuff into landfill after one use. So all of those embedded impacts, we kind of expended them for nothing. So those are my big 4. You've been cut off, man.